Chapter 3 Johnny the Blade Bladani pulled the sal from his inside coat pocket. He hit speed dial and Bang Bang Molinari immediately answered.
Go, Blade. This guy got a bus for an office?
Could be.
Why didn't no one tell me it was a bus? I ain't never broken a bus before.
Don't break in. Get invited. Goodbye.
Johnny frowned at the disconnection. He was a swarthy man, early 30s, who looked early 20s, with his baby face and baby blues. But there, everything baby about him ended. He was wearing a silver sharkskin suit with $2,000 Gucci's, silver shades hiding his eyes, and a 60s-style pompadour such as the East Coast crooners wore. The car was one of Bang Bang's Escalade SUVs, black in color, with plates that were protected by the state of Illinois DMV in case Johnny got pulled over. The designation meant, to any law enforcement officer, hands off. The driver is connected. He was sitting across the street from Victor Haro's construction yard in Orbit, where the purple bus sat just outside the gate, ready to roar off to a troubled job site on a moment's notice. Johnny was parked westbound, headed toward Orbit, and he had no flashers blinking. The lane he was in was a traffic lane, but he didn't really give a damn. Let the fools figure it out, he thought. Besides, he'd only be a minute or two. He felt around in his shirt pocket and produced a driver's license photo of Victor Haro.
Ugly bastard, he commented. Bet you ain't getting much action.
An 18-wheeler came up behind and blew out its air brakes, sliding to a stop behind Johnny. Johnny flipped the guy off, which wasn't seen by anyone due to the black windows. He laid down rubber and wheeled the caddy from the right lane across three lanes of traffic, up and across the driveway, and nosed in beside Victor's bus.
Now eat it and die, he muttered to the trucker.
He checked his hair in the rear view and went inside.
I'm here to meet Victor Haro,
Johnny said to the gum smacker behind the front desk. The girl looked up from her screen.
Is he expecting you?
He ought to be. You get my drift?
Who should I tell him is calling?
Just tell him I'm here from the governor's office. He'll understand.
Don't you have a name, sir?
The gum smacking increased in speed along with the woman's frustration.
Mr. Haro is very busy, and it's my job to screen all drop-ins.
Tell him it's Johnny Bladani from Chicago. That name opens lots of doors.
Very well.
She buzzed Victor on the telephone and waited. No answer. She buzzed again. Still no answer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Bladani. B-L-A-D-A-N-N-I.
I'm sorry, but it looks like Mr. Haro might have slipped out for lunch.
And what time does he get back?
Probably late tonight. He has stops to make at job sites.
What's he driving?
Why, you planning on pulling him over?
No. You know, just in case I happen to see him.
Company truck, purple top, cream bottom, says Haro.
I get it, Haro and Sons, down the side. Am I close?
The gum smacker sniffed.
Will that be all, Mr. Bladani?
For now. Just for now.
Do you have a card you'd like to leave for Mr. Haro?
Lady, you don't want to see my card.
Johnny smiled, patting his inside pocket where he kept his 10-inch switchblade.
Ain't nobody looking to see my card.
Later.
All right, I'll tell him you stopped by.
No, let's make it a surprise when I come back tonight.
Goodbye, sir. Have a nice afternoon.
In this town? What, do you know something fun to do here that I ain't figured out already?
Thanks again.
Later.
Victor Haro was lunching on short ribs and noodles, the noon special at the Redbird Inn, a mile west of Orbit. It was a low-slung, whitewashed restaurant from the 40s, with a sign out front in the shape of a 10-foot-high cardinal. At night, the sign blinked red and white. The joint was known locally as the Redbird Inn. It was a favorite hangout of farmers and truckers who had done business at the Sale Barn across the road, where pigs and cows were sold off to the local slaughterhouse, another mile further west. Victor Harrow's lunch guest was Bud Leininger, attorney at law, who nested in a Victorian office one block west of the Orbit Town Square. His office was in a section of town where several of the buildings on the formerly residential street were being reformulated as professionals' offices, dentists, lawyers, and a family medical practice, plus two CPA firms, plus a stockbroker who was always desperate for sales. As rural Illinoisans will invest in land, much more quickly than they will consider intangibles such as stocks and bonds. Bud was the son of D.B. Luniger, the 89-year-old lawyer who drank coffee with Thaddeus. Bud was known around orbit as a ne'er-do-well who'd rather tell a lie than the truth, even when the truth would win him a gold star for the day. He was a natural-born provocator and fabricator. In short, he had found the perfect job in the practice of law, where things are never what they're said to be. It was the afternoon before the night when Ermeline Ransom was drugged and tattooed at Victor Harrow's bus. Victor didn't know yet that Johnny the Blade Bladani was in town to see him, and so he was dining in relative peace. In fact, Victor had never even heard of Johnny the Blade. Victor's face was broad and pitted on the front. He'd started his career as a pipeline welder, working as an iron worker on the Alaska pipeline, before hanging up his helmet and gloves and returning home to orbit, where he established Harrow & Sons Construction in 1982. As a welder in Alaska, there were days he wore just goggles, and the constant sparks and hot metal had burned his face repeatedly. He wasn't disfigured, but anyone who knew construction would have guessed his line of work just by looking upon his face. He was clinically obese at 275, for he had never grown to be 6 feet, and the charts at his doctor's office were all in the red and screamed that he needed to lose 85 pounds. Victor ignored that advice, of course, and went right on eating and drinking like he always had. Everyone in orbit joined him in that. Food was a key solace for people whose lives were paid for at an hourly rate, too often minimum wage, and who had too many kids and not enough joy.
"Bud, I've got a problem," Victor said and forked a load of rib meat and noodles into his mouth.
"Hmm?" Bud muttered and went back to carefully slicing away the gristle from the meat.
"Somebody needs to talk to the cook. This ain't meat, it's fat."
"I say I've got a problem."
"What happened? You stiffed some sub? Hey, it's going around, Vic. Try not to lose any sleep over it."
"It's not that."
"Then what?"
Victor slurped his iced tea. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
I haven't been paying my kickbacks."
"You what? Have you gone nuts, Victor? You always pay upstairs," he hissed across the table. "That's playing with fire. To stiff the upstairs?"
I know that. It's just I don't know. With Marlene and Bruce doing so well, I started thinking, what the hell am I doing? I asked myself, why am I paying off the governor? After all, Bruce isn't, and he's doing gangbusters. I wanted to flip them off. I wanted to yell, hey, screw you, one time. It just got to me.
How much you behind?
It's the Springfield, Chicago job. Probably 100.
100, as in 1,000? Are you serious, man?
Bud paused, his fork halfway to his mouth. He wasn't sure he heard right.
You've held out 100 grand on the governor and his boys?
Afraid so.
Bud looked around and ducked his head.
Hey, yeah, you don't mind if I move to a different table, do you? You're like radioactive, my friend.
Victor picked apart a slab of rib.
So what do I do?
Pay up. Now. Like yesterday.
And if I haven't got it?
Borrow it. Sell something. Sell some of Betty Ann Harrell's diamonds.
Come on.
Hey, I am coming on. You're about to go up in flames. Sorry, Vic, but I can't help you with this one. This is way outside my league.
Yeah, well, who can?
Help you? Moses, Adam, and the First National Bank. Go see Brody Mathewson this afternoon over at First National. Go in and hawk if you have to, but call your bagman and let him know you have the dough before closing time today. Capiche?
Yeah.
And call me tonight. Let me know if you've paid up. If something happens to you, I'm a witness that way.
A lot of good it does me.
At just that moment, Johnny Bladani entered the Red Bird Inn. All eyes turned to see him as one because, first, he was a stranger and therefore suspect, but even more, two, in his sharkskin and Gucci's and silver shades, he was light years out of place. Everyone gave him the new guy stare for 15 seconds and then returned to stuffing their faces and talking with their mouths full. Johnny, meantime, compared the photo in his hand to the man sitting across from Bud Luniger, and he instantly knew he had located Victor Harrow. He brushed the hostess aside and glided coolly back to Victor's table.
Johnny didn't bother with an introduction. Instead, he announced, I need to talk to you.
And you are?
Victor asked, eyeing the man with all due suspicion. Let's just say the governor sent me. At this, Bud Laniger shrank even lower in his chair. He looked off to the side. He was neither hearing any of this nor participating in it. Without a word, he suddenly lurched upright, sliding his wooden captain's chair back with a loud squawk. He grabbed the lunch bill and headed for the cash register.
Nice, said Johnny admiringly. I like a man who knows when to get back to work.
You still haven't told me your name, mister.
Bladani. My friends call me the Blade.
Look, I don't have it. It's all been spent on overhead. It's all gone, sorry.
Nah, friend. That's where you're wrong. You see, the governor's share is solid as gold. It's never gone. It's always around somewhere. Now we just have to find it.
Well, my attorney, who you just jackrabbited the hell out of here, he was advising me to drop by the bank this afternoon and see how much I can get my hands on.
Johnny smiled. He walked around and sat down in Bud's chair. He scooted up to the table.
I like the sound of that. See how much I can get my hands on. Yes, that has a nice sound.
So I'll be in touch. Right now I have to get out to several job sites, Mr. Bladano.
Bladani. Bladanni. What do I gotta spell everything out to you people down here?
Well, sir, my name is Victor. V-I-C-T-O-R, and you can tell the governor I'm working on it. I'll know something by the end of the week.
No, said Johnny. You'll know something by 5 today. I'll be at the office waiting for you. I'll be waiting for a nice fat bag of 100K.
I won't be back by 5. I've got 200 miles to drive.
Then what time? I ain't leaving till we meet.
Victor sighed.
I could be back at 10:30 tonight.
You gonna bring me a present?
If the bank will loan it, I'll have it.
And if the bank won't, what then?
See you then.
Victor, let me be clear about this. You will see me again tonight, but you won't see me the next time. So don't make there be a next time after tonight, understand?
I understand. I'm doing everything I can.
Mister, you don't even begin to know what you can do.
Johnny laughed. That night, Victor returned from his stops. First, he had gone to the bank and met with Brody Mathewson. He told Brody he needed $100,000 in his account by 5 o'clock. Brody had touched his fingertips together and then started scrolling documents on his screen. He looked up Victor's general business account. He reviewed Victor's balance sheet. He checked out his last 12 months of P&Ls. He studied his asset-liability ratio to see if such a loan was even feasible. Finally, Brody had frowned and clasped his hands behind his head. He was thoughtful for a full minute, then abruptly sat up and asked Victor what the money was for. Was it going into hard assets the bank could lean? Victor said no, the money was to be used for current expenses. He explained they were having a month where outgo had outpaced income and they were meeting payroll and materials on 3 lucrative jobs. Brody nodded. He knew that enough of Victor's money flowed into the bank, that Victor was a top 10 customer. Brody and First National were, he told Victor, damn glad to have his business. But right now, with the recession and all, $100,000 unsecured was asking a lot. He wasn't sure the bank was prepared to go that far. He would have to check with the branch manager, who was out the rest of the afternoon. Victor had become animated and said that wasn't good enough, that he needed the money today, now. Several minutes passed while Brody again studied his computer screen and made repeated mouse clicks. He wasn't through looking, and that was a good sign. At long last, he broke away from his study and spread his hands. He said, we're just going to have to wait and talk to Mr. Edwards in the morning and see if the bank will cover Victor's paper, unsecured as it was. Finally, Victor had given in and stood. He shook Brody's hand energetically to let him know he wasn't upset and told him he'd be by in the morning for the money. For the money? Brody had asked. Yes, said Victor. I need the total amount in cash. Brody had done a funny thing then.
He had laughed. 100% certain Victor had been kidding about the cash. Nobody wanted cash. After the bank, Victor had climbed in his truck and driven down Baker to the Dairy Ripple. A double scoop waffle cone was called for. Food always helped, especially when it was still too early for a highball. He left the drive-thru, and that was when he first noticed the black SUV falling in behind him. Racing the cone against its melt, slurping and licking at the soft custard, Victor then drove southwest to Macomb, where a paving job was in trouble over a local union dispute. He agreed to the rewrite on the local bargaining agreement, and the reps declared they would have the workers back on the job tomorrow. Easy enough, but it took no less than Victor himself to do the deal. Then he was off to Springfield, where he had to meet with a marketing group he was toying with the idea of hiring. General contractors in Illinois had such a bad name, and Victor was no different, that he was looking into hiring Media Specials SW to improve the image of Harrow & Sons Contracting. His rationale was simple. He didn't really give a damn about the construction company. But secretly, something he'd never discussed with anyone, Victor was considering a run for the Illinois House of Representatives. How great it would be, he thought, to represent the people of his district and at the same time be contracting with their government. The possibilities were staggering. The state could throw jobs his way, his company could bid, and his Illinois House seat would be instrumental in voting to approve all such bids. It was 100% win-win and a no-brainer. His only regret that he hadn't thought of it before. So at 4:30 p.m., he was pulling into the Windsor Office Park in North Springfield, parking to go inside and hear MSSW's pitch, when he noticed the black Escalade in the rear view. It had turned into the lot right behind him. It had followed him from the freeway, he was sure of it, and now it was making no secret of the fact it was following him. Victor climbed down out of his purple over-cream truck and walked back to the Escalade. The windows were blacked out and he couldn't see the driver. He took a deep breath, hitched himself to his full 511, and knocked on the glass. Rather, he rapped on the glass with his own ignition key. The window immediately lowered. There sat the man who had visited him at lunch at the Red Bird. Johnny something. Victor put his hands on the window frame.
"You lose something, friend?"
Victor asked.
"You mean me? Did I lose something? Nah, I ain't lost nothing."
"Well, it looks like you're following me."
"You're the guy with $100,000 belongs to me. I gotta protect you."
"I won't have the money until in the morning."
"Oh, I saw you go inside the bank and everything. Don't worry."
Victor frowned.
You followed me to the bank?"
"Mr. Harrow, you ain't been out of my sight since you left that dump you was eating at. You're far too valuable to lose sight of."
Come by in the morning. I'll have it then."
Johnny Bladani raised an index finger. He waggled it under Victor's pitted nose.
No. That ain't the deal. The deal is I get my money tonight. 10 o'clock, your place, the full $100,000.
"That might have been your deal," said Victor.
He stood upright.
"But that wasn't my deal. My deal was I said I'd go by the bank and make whatever arrangements I could."
"Say what you will, Mr. Harrow. The deal is tonight. 100 and not a dime less. Your place. I'll be waiting there for you."
And if I don't show?"
"Then I'll come by your home and kick the friggin' door down. Then I'll cut your throat, rape your wife, and stab your dog. We ain't messing here, Mr. Harrow. Do we understand each other?"
Johnny's outburst had backed Victor off a full step. He'd never been talked to like that, at least not since the Alaska pipeline and some of the outlaws working those crews. Guys who carried guns and weren't afraid of anybody. Right now, he wished he had a gun, something, or someone to protect him. This was getting out of hand. What if he called Sheriff Altman? Would that help? Johnny Bladani was glaring at him. He curled his finger at Victor. Victor again closed the distance between them. Johnny held up a finger and reached inside his jacket pocket. As if it had a life of its own, the 10-inch switchblade sprung open not an inch from Victor's nose.
"See this? This is why they call me the Blade. Not for nothing, but I'm gonna slice your fat throat open tonight. You don't got my money. Now, see where you've got us to?"
Victor knew then and there that the cops weren't the answer. Chicago hoodlums far outnumbered all the law enforcement in southern Illinois. That was a fact. He could run to the cops all he wanted and have Johnny arrested for threatening him.
the mob would just send another, and then another, and then they'd get tired of the routine and simply blow his house up with him and Betty Ann Harrow inside. He was trapped, and he knew it.
I don't want us there, honestly, Victor managed to say. No need for that. I've got a meeting.
I'll be right here. I ain't going nowhere.
On the drive back to orbit, Victor's first call was to Brody Mathewson at First National. He asked Brody could he call Mr. Edwards at home about the loan. He was desperate and stood to look a great deal of money if the loan funds weren't available today. Brody said he would try. Call him back in 10. Victor drove on, exceeding the speed limit now while the black caddy hung on his tail. After several minutes, but probably less than 10, he redialed Brody. Brody was sorry, but Mr. Edwards was out of town until tomorrow morning. Victor would just have to wait until then. Victor managed a weak thanks to Brody and ended the call. Now what? Just after dark, Victor wheeled the purple over cream truck into the lot beside the Silver Dome on Monroe Street. He turned off the ignition and waited until the black SUV pulled in beside him. Several minutes ticked by. It became clear to Victor that Johnny Ladani wasn't going to be the first to get out of his vehicle. Victor opened his door and went around the tailgate of his truck and went into the front door of the Silver Dome. The front entrance was actually a short hall parallel to the street, and if you went through the door to the left, you would enter the restaurant, and if you went to the right, you would enter the lounge. Victor went into the lounge. He was immediately assailed by loud hellos, and there he is, calls from the Westtown crew. He called back to his workers and indicated he had to hit the restroom, which he did. When he came back out, he slid into the booth as his men made room. Ermeline Ransom came right over and asked what he was having. They bantered back and forth while Victor scanned the room for Johnny Bladani. He was nowhere to be seen, so Victor ordered a round for his men, a bud for himself, and a burger and fries. Make that a cheeseburger and fries. Without making a note, Ermeline nodded, touched the side of her head, smiled at the gathering, and headed for the kitchen to place the order. Victor stayed late, for him anyway, at the Silver Dome that night, and when he left at 10, it was with Ermeline Ransom following in her aging Impala. Victor noted, with huge relief, that the black SUV was nowhere to be seen. Looked like they had decided to give him until morning after all, he thought, and smiled. Damn, but he was charming, and after all, he did intend to pay them. He really wasn't stalling. It was all just a matter of making the paperwork fit together at the bank. Ermeline had agreed to a single glass of champagne to celebrate Victor's new contract with the state, or so she had been told. Truth of the matter was, Victor needed her at the office with him in case Johnny Bladani showed up while Victor was passing out tomorrow's crew assignments to his crew chief cells. Ermeline suspected nothing, wanted only to have a drink and go home to her son, and promised herself she'd be long gone by 10:30. Victor was, after all, a hell of a good customer and someone she would go out of her way to make happy, at least within reason.